This is Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. It's been a little over 2 months since the devastating earthquake and tsunami in Japan wrecked the Fukushima nuclear power station, releasing enough radiation to have analysts comparing it to Chernobyl. Only very recently have workers been able to get in-person views of some parts of the damaged reactors there. What are they seeing inside, and how is that new information changing the plan for how to respond to the unprecedented situation? Joining me now is Ed Lyman. He's been tracking developments at the power plant, and he's a senior scientist with the Global Security Program of the Union of Concerned Scientists in Washington. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
You know, it's almost as if this story has dropped off the radar screen here in the States.
Yes, well, that is the trend, you know, is if things aren't blowing up every day, then people tend to forget, but the situation is still pretty serious.
How serious is it? Give us an update and where we stand now with it.
Well, the update is that the authorities have learned what a lot of people pretty much have figured all along, that in three reactors, the nuclear fuel has completely melted and is now sitting at the bottom of the steel reactor vessels, and that is actually probably going to complicate the ability to stabilize the situation further.
What about the cooling situation? Are they able to keep it cool?
They are providing cooling, but they haven't yet brought these cores to what they call cold shutdown, which is bringing them below the boiling point of water. And as a result, they're cooling by continuing to dump water into the reactor vessels. That's boiling off the steam. It's condensing as contaminated water, and it's ending up in the basements of these buildings and still leaking probably into the groundwater and into the sea, so that they don't have a stable closed circuit to maintain cooling at this point.
Does that mean that the melted core is stable itself? It's not melting through the China syndrome, as we used to call it?
Well, it does appear that way. It looks like they were able to stabilize the situation before these cores actually melted through completely the steel vessel. In that case, it would have dropped down to the floor of the containment building and potentially even eaten through the containment. So the situation isn't as bad as it could have been, but the vessels are believed to be leaking. There are holes in them, and there are also holes in the containment building. So anything you put in is still finding its way out.
So you're basically, by pouring water in and it flushing out, you're just basically flushing radioactive material to the outside.
That does seem to be the consequence. They're washing huge quantities of radioactive water into the basements of the buildings, and that's causing an enormous cleanup problem they're going to have to face for a long time to come.
And so is there a plan, or is it what?
Well, the original plan would be to flood the containment buildings with water. They knew that the vessels weren't completely full. That's the steel vessel within the containment. But they didn't realize they were completely empty, which means that there are holes probably at the bottom. So the original plan was to flood the containment buildings and try to cover the cores that way. But since the containment buildings also all seem to be leaking, their new plan is to build a system which would extract the water that's leaking out of the containment buildings, run it through filters, clean it up, and put it back in the reactor. So they're going to have to siphon off all the contaminated water that's collecting in the basements.
Is that sort of like building a moat around it and pumping out the water as it leaks out, or how?
They'll have to build a new piping system with pumps that will, draw the water out of these buildings.
So we're talking about something that's going to take many months, and in all that time, the radioactivity will continue to leak out.
Yes, unfortunately, that seems to be the situation. Their estimate is to have the reactors in cold shutdown within 6 to 9 months. That's probably an optimistic assessment, but to deal with all the radioactivity that's already gotten into the environment and to actually stabilize the cores, package the material safely, and eventually decontaminate the site, that's you're talking about decades.
And as far as those holding ponds, are they in a different situation or basically in the same situation?
Well, they've managed to stabilize the leaks that they know about. They've used a mineral called zeolite, which absorbs certain radioactive isotopes to try to soak up some of the radiation and keep it from spilling to the environment. But there's already been a lot that's been released, both in the water and also in the air. So there's also contamination of ground farmland tens of miles downwind from the site.
Would it be fair then at this point? I know when the accident first happened, people were comparing it to Three Mile Island. Have we moved over to a Chernobyl comparison?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think the comparison is that useful. This is definitely a very, very severe event. It's led to a massive amount of radiation released into the environment and a cleanup problem that's going to take decades. I think it's, qualitatively speaking, as bad as Chernobyl.
And how are the Japanese taking this?
The Japanese are reacting with a lot of concern. Japan, nuclear power was a big part of Japan's energy strategy for hundreds of years. They wanted to build a new fleet of reactors called fast breeder reactors, use plutonium fuel. It was really part of their self-identity is having a big nuclear power program, and this has caused a shock to the system that's really turned public opinion around. It's led the government to require the shutdown of other plants that are in seismically active areas, and I think it's causing a real reconsideration of nuclear power in Japan.
So things will just stay at the status quo until they're able to change that, whenever that may be.
Yes, I mean, they've identified eight areas that they need to address, not only cooling the reactors and the spent fuel pools, but stabilizing the site in the event of further seismic events or tsunamis. They need to improve the situation of the workers at the site. That's very important because the working conditions have been terrible, not just because of the radiation levels, but also basic human needs. And they also need to build covers around the reactors and to deal with contaminated topsoil. It's just a whole laundry list of chores, and they are making slow progress, but there was no playbook for how to deal with this type of situation, so they're making things up as they go along.
All right, Ed, thanks for checking in with us.
Thank you.
Ed Lyman, he's been tracking the developments at the Fukushima nuclear reactor. He is a senior scientist with the Global Security Program of the Union of Concerned Scientists in Washington.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Not every day we get to make contact with the International Space Station.
NPR, this is Houston. Please call Endeavour and ISS for a voice check.
Endeavour, ISS, this is NPR. How do you hear me?
Loud and clear, Scott. How do you have us?
Ah, just fine. How are you, Mark?
I am really good. Katie and I are enjoying a good day up here.
That's Endeavour Commander Mark Kelly speaking from the International Space Station. We caught up with Commander Kelly and Flight Engineer Katie Coleman on Thursday. Ms. Coleman's been on board the International Space Station since December. Mark Kelly arrived this week via Space Shuttle Endeavour. Of course, this is the final mission for Endeavour and the second-to-last voyage before NASA ends its shuttle program later this year. Commander Kelly, this journey has added significance. His wife, Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords, is recovering from a gunshot wound she sustained during an attack in Tucson in January. He and Katie Coleman spoke with us from the space station, 200 miles above the Earth, and told us first about the mission.
We just installed the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer. It's a $2 billion cosmic particle detector, really a premier physics experiment that's supported by 16 different countries, 600 physicists. It's a pretty big project managed out in CERN, Switzerland. They've been working on this thing, a lot of people, for a long time, and today we got it successfully installed on the space station. A great day for science.
Yeah. Katie Coleman, what do you do with your time up there?
Well, I don't know where the time goes, but I'll tell you, it's a very busy place. We've got like 130 different experiments running almost at the same time, some of them. Up here on the space station, and then maintaining the space station, and also maintaining ourselves and doing some medical work, some medical experiments, just to maintain your bone mass. You need to exercise about 2 hours a day up here. So I would say every day is a busy day and a great day up here.
This might well be your last ride in space. I wonder what your thoughts are as you look down on our Earth?
You know, the Earth's an incredibly beautiful planet. It's it's hard to understand sometimes all the conflict in such a beautiful place. You know, it is it's possible that this is my last flight. You know, this is a really hard thing to give up. It's very exciting to, and it's a, be frank, it's a big privilege for all of us to have the opportunity to serve our countries in this way. So it's a tough thing. But to answer your question, Scott, you know, just looking down, we've got a very fragile and beautiful place to live, and we need to take care of it.
Do both of you, either of you, have any concern that NASA is no longer going to be leading the way?
You know, I think, you know, NASA is leading the way and will continue to do so. We are the lead partner on the International Space Station, and when humans go back to the moon and onto Mars, I'm sure it's going to be the United States and NASA that's leading that as well. As we move into more commercialization of the launch vehicles and getting access to orbit, that's still, you know, NASA that's leading that project and hopefully buying those services. And this is something I think that in the long run could mean, the expansion of humans accessing space. So we're pretty excited about the future for NASA.
Katie Coleman, when you look down on the Earth, what do you think?
You know, you would think after almost 6 months that I might even be tired of it, and I will tell you that it's always changing. You know, different kinds of light, different just discovering new places. I feel like I've been to these places, and during my time up here, we've had the earthquake and tsunami in Japan, the conflict in Libya, and the flooding in the south. Lots of things happening down on the planet, and it's hard to look at in that way because when we look from here, it still looks beautiful and somehow remote. And so trying to marry up those two things, you know, the reality of how hard life is down on the planet for so many people right now, and yet our view is very, very angelic, really. And so it's hard to marry up those two things, and I'm not looking forward to giving that up. It's very hard to give it up.
Flight engineer Katie Coleman, Commander Mark Kelly, thanks so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome, Scott.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Michelle Norris.
I'm Robert Siegel, and it's now time for All Tech Considered. If you're making a summer books list, there's a new title out from an online humorist. His email exchanges with unsuspecting victims have been going viral for years. NPR's Shireen Meraji sat down with the author of The Internet is a Playground, Irreverent Correspondences of an Evil Online Genius.
This email exchange went viral a while ago. Maybe someone sent it to you. In my head, it sounded a little something like this.
Dear David, our records indicate that your account is overdue by the amount of $233.95. If you have already made this payment, please contact us within the next 7 days to confirm payment has been applied to your account and is no longer outstanding.
Dear Jane, I do not have any money, so I'm sending you this drawing I did of a spider instead. I value the drawing at $233.95, so I trust that this settles the matter. Regards, David.
Basically, this David guy is trying to pay a real chiropractor bill with an elementary drawing of a spider. The woman he's emailing is not amused. The email exchange is funny to some, but to others, David comes off as a bit of a bully.
You reckon it's me?
That's the real David, David Thorne. He's an Aussie.
I never initiate the conversation. If somebody's initiating it, then really it's up to them if they want to end the discussion or whatnot.
But for Thorne, it's best when they keep hitting send. It all started when the chain-smoking, 30-something graphic designer single dad from Adelaide, Australia, was bored at work. He'd instigate email arguments with co-workers, landlords, friends, and school chaplains. He'd write outlandish stories on internet forums that would get him kicked out by irritated moderators. Why? He says it's because it made him laugh.
People use the word troll, but I'm not on there to upset people or anything like that. I'm just basically go on these forums and write little stories. I'm a designer, but it's a lot more fun writing than it is laying out business cards.
Thorne put his funniest stuff on his website, 27b/6.com. And when he posted that spider email exchange, he realized he wasn't the only one chuckling.
Before the spider email, the website was probably getting 500 hits a week. After the spider email was posted, I think it was about 500,000 hits a day, and the servers just collapsed.
Thorne needed a dedicated server, but hosting charges were pricey. So he gathered his online pranks and stories into a self-published book, The Internet is a Playground. A real publisher picked it up, and it recently made the New York Times bestseller list. Thorne is adamant that none of this could have happened if his work didn't make some people laugh and others shake their heads in disgust.
If I post something and I get five comments and they're all, that was funny, that was good and everything, then yes, I'll jump in there under a construct's name and say that was terrible, the guy's an idiot. Because that's the only way to create the factions. Factions are gold. They're just priceless. Been doing that for years. That's terrible, isn't it?
I tried to reach a couple of people in the anti-Thorne faction, but only one got back to me, Shannon Walkley. She was the admin assistant at the branding firm where he worked and a repeat target of Thorne's email shenanigans.
She filed three formal complaints because she didn't like my sense of humor. And I'd steal things from her desk, and I think I just wore her out after a while.
Shannon Walkley declined an interview in an email saying, "Sorry, this is probably just another one of his tricks anyway, and I don't care about his book or his stupid website." So is David Thorne an online humorist or a grown-up bully trolling the web for victims? Either way you look at it, the internet is his playground. Shireen Marisol Meraji, NPR News.
And you can read excerpts from The Internet is a Playground at npr.org/alltech.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. If the traders on Mt. Gox understand the future, we all may soon see prices online quoted in dollars and euros and BTC, bitcoins. What is Bitcoin?
Bitcoin is the first decentralized digital currency. Bitcoins are digital coins you can send through the internet. Compared to other alternatives, bitcoins have a number of advantages.
That's from a video at weusecoins.com. Bitcoins are bought and sold on Mt. Gox, which is also a website. Think of it as an online Bitcoin exchange. If you're lost right now, I'm right there with you. And so joining us to help us both out and explain the currency whose promoters say it will do to banking what the internet did to publishing is Annie Lowrey, economy and business reporter for Slate. Hi.
Thank you for having me.
And first of all, how would one use Bitcoins?
So right now, you can use bitcoins to purchase anything that people who are accepting bitcoins are selling. So there are some goods and some services that you can find on a number of bitcoin trading sites. You can buy things like everything from computer web design to alpaca socks you can purchase. So there's a small community of people who accept bitcoins, and they sell a pretty wide variety of things, but mostly sort of tech products right now.
So far, it's kind of like an online digital script. There are no real coins. There are no physical coins that we're talking about.
There are no physical coins, no. Basically, in order to possess a Bitcoin, you have to have a program on your computer that can help trade the Bitcoins, and then it's stored on your computer in what's called a digital wallet.
And Bitcoins have a value. One Bitcoin, according to what it says on Mt. Gox today, one Bitcoin's a little bit over $7.
Exactly. So the coins are tradable. On Mt. Gox, you can take dollars and purchase bitcoins, or you can simply purchase bitcoins from anybody who has a bitcoin. There's no central banking authority. There really is no banking system that supports this. It's entirely peer-to-peer.
And there's also a method too complex for us to go into here called mining bitcoins, where by some algorithm you can get them in blocks of some predetermined size. The whole point here is this is confidential. This is anonymous. And in theory, if I were somebody trying to launder money or sell a stolen painting, this is the perfect way to do it.
Indeed, there's no record of the transaction. So say that you and I were drug dealers and we wanted to exchange some money internationally. If we were to try and do that through the banking system, all sorts of red flags would go off. There would be a record of the transaction. Our banks might stop it. You know, the authorities in either of our countries might be able to stop it, and they would also be able to track it. That's not true with Bitcoins at all. It would just be me sending them to you directly, computer to computer. There's no record afterwards. But the transaction would indeed be secure. You would receive my funds or I would receive yours.
So this is ostensibly an advantage of dealing in bitcoins. Have you yet seen something for sale online, apart from doing your story about bitcoins? Have you stumbled across a site where you've seen a price quoted in bitcoins?
I have not.
No.
I would not be surprised if at some point, especially again for, most of the trade in bitcoins right now is among people who are fairly sophisticated sort of computer programmer types. And so I wouldn't be surprised if you started to see, some very webby companies start accepting bitcoins. But right now there's so much volatility in the currency that it's kind of risky asset.
Annie Lowrie, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Annie Lowrie is economy and business reporter for Slate.